This is the Josh Hammer Show.
Is the United States Supreme Court going to potentially dictate the outcome of the 2024 presidential election, the forthcoming rematch between Joe Biden and Donald Trump? That is the question on all of our minds right now. Of the four prosecutions currently unfolding against former President Trump, the one that so many of us just last year thought would be the killer one, the prosecution down in Fulton County, Georgia, that prosecution is collapsing before our very eyes. Fannie Willis, the corrupt and scandal-ridden district attorney, not looking very good there. That case will probably end up being moved out of Fulton County, Georgia. That means that the case where the Biden regime, the Merrick Garland, Jack Smith, Democrat lawfare complex apparatus, the crown jewel where they are putting all of their eggs in the basket, is the case in Washington, D.C. The case pertaining to the 2020 election, the events leading up to January 6, 2021, basically the allegation that in seeking to quote unquote overturn the election, Donald Trump and his co-defendants acted in mafia-like fashion in a sprawling nationwide criminal conspiracy to do blah, 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 blah. Now, the question in the D.C. Circuit, if you've been paying attention, is whether President Trump is actually immune from prosecution for these very acts, because he was doing them while he was the commander-in-chief, while he had the quote-unquote executive power of which Article 2, Section 1, Clause 1 of the Constitution speaks. Is he immune, in other words, for actions not merely as the sitting president of the United States? That is long-standing, uncontroversial policy going back to a 1973 memo in the Nixon era Department of Justice. You definitely can't be prosecuted if you are a sitting president. In fact, the other special counsel, Robert Hur, just concluded and reaffirmed as much in his report out earlier in February about Joe Biden's mental state and his own classified documents retention scandal. But can you be immune after you pass the baton, after you are no longer sitting there in the Oval Office? If the answer to that question is yes, then Donald Trump cannot be prosecuted in Jack Smith's D.C. case. He can still be prosecuted in the Florida case, the classified documents retention case, because that pertains to conduct wholly after his time as president. But that case is not the crown jewel for many reasons. The jury pool, it's in Florida, a more politically heterodox jury pool. For a lot of reasons, the Biden regime is putting all of their eggs in the basket in Jack Smith's Washington, D.C. case. And we just found out this past Wednesday that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to expedite a hearing on the question of whether the former president of the United States, Donald Trump, is immune from prosecution for the Jack Smith prosecution there in Washington, D.C. They're going to hear oral argument in late April. They will give us a decision by the end of the term in late June. Supreme Court watchers, you know that the justices have a flair for the dramatic when it comes to this sort of thing. The Dobbs abortion case 2 terms ago, the Bruin gun case 2 terms ago, the affirmative action case last term. They like to save the juicy stuff for last. But this is an expedited hearing. We are barely now into March and talking about an oral argument getting on the calendar in late April. This thing is going to move rapid fire. If the justices do hold that Donald Trump is fully immune, that he has absolute unqualified immunity, that would be a massive, massive coup for Donald Trump. It would be a huge, huge aid to his reelection efforts. Of course, the exact opposite result, saying that he is not immune, that presidents in general do not have immunity after they leave their time in office, that would be the best case scenario for Jack Smith and the prosecution. It would go right down to the lower court judge, Tanya Chutkan, there in the district court in Washington, D.C., for a trial to commence. Now, even then, in this worst case scenario for Trump, it's worth bearing in mind that the actual trial itself probably still wouldn't start until August at the absolute earliest, probably September. You have pretrial motions, you have discovery requests, all that sort of stuff. Only then, after the Supreme Court weighs in, would the trial court start to do all of that. So we're talking early July at that point. The middle ground possible outcome, which I see many legal eagles are starting to speculate about. Harvard Law School professor Jack Goldsmith had a long thread on Twitter, X, whatever we're calling that platform these days, where he basically half guessed that the court would go down this route. And it makes a lot of sense. And in this hypothetical, they would take a middle ground outcome, very John Roberts-like, always trying to find the middle ground, right? And here, what they would do is they would say that there are some acts that fall within the constitutional ambit in your core Article II presidential executive power, commander-in-chief prerogative functions. But there are some acts that fall outside that ambit, and the latter acts, those that are not explicitly part of the constitutional sphere of influence for the president, acts taken outside of that can be prosecuted after you leave office. So think here, to kind of put some teeth on that, of a possible distinction between firing a bureaucrat, which is a core Article II executive power function. A core Article II function similarly would be using the U.S. military. That's your commander-in-chief prerogative. Think of that versus, you know, hiring an assassin to kill your mistress before your wife finds out, right? I mean, most reasonable people can discern the difference there. So it's possible that the Supreme Court ends up doing this and then kicks it down to a lower court to engage in more fact-finding to figure out whether these specific acts here are in bucket one or bucket two. All of this would have the combined effect of just further delaying Judge Tanya Chutkan's trial there in federal district court in Washington, D.C. These dilatory tactics, these stall-ball, run-out-the-clock tactics, is exactly what the Trump legal team is hoping for at this point. They desperately, desperately do not want a jury to be able to reach a verdict there in Jack Smith's crown jewel case, the federal prosecution in Washington, D.C. Looking at the votes right now, I think you have Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito, the two most stalwart conservatives on the Supreme Court. They are probably solid votes for absolute immunity. They're strong Article II, strong pro-presidential power jurists. That's what I had to guess. I think you probably do have five, maybe even six votes on the court for that middle ground. Some acts are immune, some acts are not immune. Let's kick it down to the lower courts to figure it out. You probably do have five or six votes for that outcome. But the key point here is that the United States Supreme Court, once again, finds itself inevitably, perhaps, smack in the middle of a presidential election. What is John Roberts going to do, the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court? On the one hand, he has pro-presidential power inclinations. The Trump versus Hawaii decision from the Trump presidency comes to mind. That was a 5-4 immigration decision pertaining to the so-called Muslim ban, as the mainstream media called it. Really just a prudential measure to stop taking in migrants from explicitly war-torn, terror-exporting countries. Roberts had a very pro-presidential powers opinion there in Trump versus Hawaii. John Roberts is also known to harbor a deep personal, at times perhaps even seething animus for Donald J. Trump. And do not underestimate, do not discount how much something like that, as petty as it may be, do not discount how much that might actually matter in a potentially election-altering case of this magnitude. We're going to be paying attention to all these cases here throughout the course of our year on the show, of course, but this is the case to watch. The one in Washington, D.C. is the case. Alvin Bragg's absolutely stupid, idiotic Stormy Daniels, Michael Cohen, fraudulent bookkeeping hush money case in New York. That trial starting on March 25th, they're probably going to get a verdict in time. I don't think anyone cares. That trial, that prosecution is facially a joke. Again, the Biden regime is putting their eggs at this point, given the collapse of the Georgia prosecution. They're putting all of their eggs in the basket of Jack Smith's election case in Washington, D.C., and you really couldn't write any better if you were a Hollywood scriptwriter. The U.S. Supreme Court is now front and center in this grand election year battle.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
As if you needed more data points indicating that the Republican Party is now firmly and unequivocally the party of Trump, one of Trump's longtime kind of friends, but also kind of enemies within the Republican Party, Mitch McConnell, announced that he is stepping down. Crazy news. Mitch McConnell is the longest serving major party caucus leader in the history of the United States Senate. Let me say that again, because it's actually a crazy, crazy fact. No one has led his or her party in the United States Senate as majority slash minority leader in the entire history of what was once known, not anymore perhaps, but what was once known as the world's greatest deliberative body, than Mitch McConnell. He has been in that perch for roughly 17 years or so, and he has announced that he is stepping down after November. He says that he is not necessarily retiring from the Senate right away, but at a bare minimum, he is going to step aside from that leadership perch. You already have a big race unfolding rapidly. The so-called three Johns, John Cornyn of Texas, John Thune of South Dakota, and John Barrasso of Wyoming. All uninspiring choices, if we're being pretty candid here, but all three of them seem to be the front runners. So there's been a lot of chatter about Senator Rick Scott, the junior senator from the state of Florida as well. Rick Scott was the last to openly challenge Mitch McConnell for that gig. His bid did not go very far when he did so. So it's time to talk a little bit about Mitch McConnell, about his legacy, about what he has done and what he has not done. The typical conservative reaction to Mitch McConnell, which I largely but do not exclusively agree with, is that he is a thorn in the side of conservatives and that we should be grateful to see him step aside. There is no doubt that, largely speaking, this is true. Virtually every time in my entire adulthood, my entire time following politics, virtually every time House and Senate conservatives are trying to engage in brinksmanship, trying to take a budget battle to the brink, they're trying to get meaningful spending cuts, they're trying to do this, do that, it kind of always seems like Mitch McConnell is on the other side. He very much is a spokesperson for the very uniparty ruling class that we decry week in and week out on this very program. There really is no doubt about that. I mean, look at the Russia-Ukraine war as just one glaring recent example. I saw a Babylon Bee headline. Got to hand it to the folks at Babylon Bee. They never disappoint, really. And the headline I saw was, "Ukraine to lose highly valued senator this fall." That being Mitch McConnell. And Mitch McConnell is a regular vote for the military-industrial complex. He is a regular vote for a milquetoast approach to immigration. He was a big booster of the Jim Lankford immigration proposal, this bipartisan deal that thankfully is not going anywhere. It was a horrible deal for immigration enforcement. He is unreliable on the border. I could go on and on. What I want to say to my fellow conservatives in particular, though, is not to necessarily throw the baby out with the bathwater. If you look at Mitch McConnell's legacy when it comes to judicial nominees and judicial confirmations in particular, he has a lot to rest on his laurels about. There is one element of his legacy in particular that I think is going to be his shining achievement of all. Think back to February 2016. It was right around the time of a South Carolina Republican presidential primary debate. I remember it very well. It was right around my birthday that year. It was a Saturday evening, and we all find out that Antonin Scalia has just passed away at a ranch in West Texas. Horrible, horrible news. Antonin Scalia, one of the most legendary conservative justices of the U.S. Supreme Court over the past 100 years or so. Immediately, the right, this is an election year, 2016, the right starts belting out in unison, we have to leave this seat open. Let the voters decide on it this November. And then just as loudly, coming from the opposite direction, the left says, oh my God, we have a Democratic president. Let's go get our nominee. Barack Obama ends up nominating Merrick Garland. And Mitch McConnell, to his great credit, Mitch McConnell, along with Chuck Grassley, who was the head of the Judiciary Committee at that time, they put the stop on Merrick Garland. Technically speaking, under the constitutional language, the president, quote, nominates with the, quote, advice and consent of the Senate, a judicial nominee. Now, there were some liberal legal commentators who were saying, oh, the Senate has to at least advise and consent. Well, they were advising, and by not voting, they were advising. Their advice was, don't nominate him. They were under no obligation to hold a sham hearing, and they didn't. And that seat, Scalia's seat, stayed open for that entire year until the election. There were 8 justices on the court, not the full 9. That single move from Mitch McConnell, again with Chuck Grassley, he deserves credit here as well. That single move probably did more than anything else, honestly, to secure the election victory that fall for Donald Trump. If you look at the exit polling from the 2016 presidential election, Republican voters who pulled the lever for Trump said that their number one voting issue was control of the United States Supreme Court. Translation, they wanted to be able to get the successor they wanted to the great Antonin Scalia. Unfortunately, that successor ended up being Neil Gorsuch, who's been something of a disappointment on many high-profile issues, but he's been okay. The point is, McConnell really, really masterminded that whole operation. More generally speaking, over the 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency, McConnell was the wingman. He was getting record numbers of lower court nominees. And unlike Trump's 3 Supreme Court justices, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and the aforementioned Neil Gorsuch, all of whom are fairly squishy, none of them are rock solid. None of them are Thomas or Alito. Unlike that, the lower court nominees that Trump and McConnell worked hand in hand to get across the finish line were almost unanimously dynamic. Now, there are a few duds in there, but a very, very high percentage of the Trump-nominated federal district court judges and appeals court judges were very good. I know from experience here, I clerked on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in the year 2018. I clerked for a Trump nominee, Judge James C. Ho, to that court. I literally saw that court transformed with my own eyes. Remarkable stuff. So, at the end of the day, I am happy, for sure, to see Mitch McConnell go, if for no other reason than his glaring health issues, I think, suggest that he needs to take a lesser role. We saw what happened last summer in those 2 very scary press conferences where he just froze mid-sentence for 30 seconds. Awful stuff. Anyone who has an older relative should be sympathetic to this. But my only word of advice to fellow conservatives would be, yes, he is a uniparty globalist, establishment figure, a toady of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. All that is true in many, many, most ways, indeed. But don't throw the baby entirely out with the bathwater here. Be grateful that Merrick Garland is not a United States Supreme Court justice, and that we have Neil Gorsuch for all of his flaws instead of Justice Merrick Garland.
This is the Josh Hammer Show.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Unless you've been living under a rock for the past few weeks, you probably have noticed leftists across the whole country screaming, bellowing from the top of their lungs about theocracy, Christian nationalism down in the state of Alabama. How could those rednecks talk about the Bible in a judicial opinion? How could those rednecks try to say that an embryo is a human being? This is a case from the Alabama Supreme Court from mid-February called LePage. And there has been so much gross misinformation and disinformation on this particular case that I need to spend a few moments just clearing the air here and explaining to you what the mainstream media has so pathetically failed to do. Let's start with the facts, because the fact pattern here is really important to understand. Again, something else the media has totally failed to do for the most part. You're dealing with a fertility clinic, an IVF clinic, in one of the largest hospitals in the state of Alabama, in the state capital of Montgomery, I believe. And what you had was the fertility clinic inexplicably failing to secure, literally secure the doors to its facility. Like they didn't lock the doors or something like that. And you had a patient wander into the facility, maybe from a different wing of the hospital. Maybe it's one of the parents of the embryos that are in the clinic. Who knows? And kind of a bizarre thing. Maybe the guy was acting in a drunken stupor. It's really neither here nor there for present purposes. So he goes, after wandering into this unlocked facility, right into where the embryos are being stored. And he starts to pull out one of the embryo trays. Now, the problem is that this is a cryogenic nursery, and the dude is touching something with sub-zero temperatures, like really freaking cold. So he obviously just goes, ah, and drops the tray. The embryos smash all over the floor. They're dead. Done. The legal question and the lawsuit that was filed was from the biological parents of some of the embryos file suit against the fertility clinic on essentially a negligence claim, but they file it under the Alabama statute that is the Wrongful Death of a Minor Act. This is a law in Alabama that goes back to 1872 initially. It's been amended a handful of times there. That's the fact pattern, is the embryonic parents of the destroyed embryos file this negligence suit under the Wrongful Death of a Minor statute against the fertility clinic. Now, This is a crucial detail. This is a very, very important detail. Again, another detail that the media never tells you. Under the terms of the Wrongful Death of a Minor statute in Alabama is this debate over how to interpret the phrase minor child. That's kind of the purpose of the whole statute, right? Well, as it turns out, the Alabama Supreme Court has consistently held in an uninterrupted line of cases that unborn children in the womb constitute quote unquote minor children for purposes of the Wrongful Death of a Minor Act. And here's the kicker. That understanding, according to the Alabama Supreme Court's interpretation of their own laws, applies in the womb for unborn children at any gestational period, from embryo until the ninth month of pregnancy. In fact, that understanding is so baked in, is so readily understood, apparently, in Alabama jurisprudence, that neither party challenged it. Put another way, even the defendant here, the clinic itself, did not challenge the idea that unborn children in the womb count as, quote, minor children under this statute. That was not before the court. The very, very narrow legal question that confronted the Alabama Supreme Court in the LePage case was whether to take that same well-developed, uninterrupted understanding of unborn children constituting minor children under the statute and then applying it to unborn children outside of the womb, which we now have as a result of in vitro fertilization and various other technologies. There was simply no other way for the court to decide this case. The alternative, which would hold that embryos outside of the womb are not protected by the statute, but embryos inside of the womb are, is something for the legislature. The court had nothing whatsoever to go on there. It would be pure legislating from the bench. It would be pure moral theorizing, moral philosophizing, for the justices to possibly say and create this exception, an extra uterine exception, to use the term from the majority opinion, and to thereby treat embryos outside the womb differently than inside the womb. If you want to categorically treat unborn human life at an equivalent gestational period differently, whether it is in utero or extra utero, then say that. Make a law that says that, Alabama. There was no role for the judiciary to do anything else. I think it's actually an extraordinarily straightforward case of statutory interpretation. I read the opinion and I barely bat an eyelash. I was like, okay, like that's obviously correct. Again, under Alabama's own understanding of its wrongful death of a minor statute and what constitutes a, quote, minor child for purposes of that statute. Now, the real kicker and probably the real reason, frankly, that you had so many leftists freaking out, I mean, heck, they're really still freaking out, is not necessarily this legally straightforward majority opinion from Justice J. Mitchell, but even more so than that, the concurring opinion from the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, a man by the name of Tom Parker. So he has attracted the most outrage here because he interprets an amendment to the Alabama Constitution passed in 2018, known as the so-called Sanctity of Life Amendment. And that amendment actually had nothing to do with the outcome of this case because, again, it was an open and shut case of statutory interpretation. But it could, in theory, have been a tiebreaker. The amendment is basically a rule of construction that urges judges and perhaps even lawmakers to err on the side of human life. So this concurring opinion from the Chief Justice basically just explores the meaning of the term, quote-unquote, sanctity of life as it is used in that 2018 amendment. And what he concludes properly is that the specific word sanctity cannot be understood in anything other than a specific religious and theological connotation. There is no secular sanctity. It's an oxymoron in and of itself. And from there, that's how he gets to what the left has noted is quoting the book of Genesis, how we are all made in the image of God, Genesis 1:27, the famous quote from the book of Jeremiah, quote, when I had not yet formed you in the womb, I knew you. He quotes some other authoritative religious authorities, folks like John Calvin, Thomas Aquinas. The very simple point I want to make here is that this is not theocracy or Christian nationalism. First of all, he had very good reason for going there, as I just explained. He's interpreting the meaning of sanctity of human life as it was used by Alabama voters when they approved this amendment. And he concludes properly that the term sanctity has to be religious. Therefore, that's how you start citing the religious stuff. Pretty straightforward. But more generally speaking, this idea that you can't quote scripture or God in public life is categorically insane. Tell that to Thomas Jefferson, a man who was a deist, the furthest thing from an Orthodox Christian, when he famously said that, quote, all men are created equal and that they, quote, are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Was Thomas Jefferson a Christian nationalist? Are you out of your freaking mind? The guy who literally redacted his own Bible to get rid of the miracles that he couldn't bring himself to believe? Was George Washington a Christian nationalist when in 1789, his famous Thanksgiving proclamation began, quote, it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey his will, to be grateful for his benefits, and so forth and so forth. Folks, this is not Christian nationalism. This is not theocracy. It is common sense statutory interpretation in this particular case, but more generally speaking, this is Anglo-American jurisprudence going all the way back 500-600 years to the English common law. You don't get here without God and scripture. I, for one, was very happy to see Chief Justice Tom Parker reaffirm that in his concurring opinion in the LePage case.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
It's Hammer Time.
Complaint accuses Columbia Hospital DEI chief of extensive plagiarism. Stop me if you've heard this story before. Dude by the name of Alade McKen has been accused of lifting entire passages from many authors for his dissertation, which he published in 2021. This dissertation was a so-called case study examining the experiences of an African-centered rites of passage program, blah, 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 blah. Look, I'm laughing because how many times do we have to see this story play out before you start to see an unavoidable pattern here? Whether it is Claudine Gay at Harvard, whether it is this dude here at Columbia, is there a single DEI chief or DEI head honcho in the country who has not plagiarized him or herself to the top of the intersectional food chain and the top of the American university hierarchy? Because if you exist out there and you have not plagiarized yourself, then go ahead and raise your hand. I suspect that the answer, to an extent, is probably that such a person does not exist, for the very simple reason that the entire existence of DEI, so-called diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, is a sham. It's a total sham. This is a garbage made up pseudo-science, pseudo-academic field. And when you have people trying to publish works in a field that is totally made up, that is entirely about our feelings and we are aggrieved and we feel oppressed, when you're making all this crap up, then it stands to reason, how much can you make up? You're going to start to copy people. So absolutely appalling, but hardly surprising in the least stuff here from Columbia. Good work as well for the investigative journalists who continue to expose just these utter frauds in the academy. You know, when it comes to people like Claudine Gay and Alade McKen, you are not helping. You are setting the very people that you are purporting to help backwards when you get exposed for lying and getting up the career food chain in this kind of fashion. You got to stop, guys. DEI hasn't died. The rise of neurodiversity and multi-generational diversity. So neuroinclusion and neurodiversity, these are terms that you've probably started to see thrown about in the public discourse. This is an umbrella concept for accommodating individuals with a whole suite of developmental and learning disabilities, everything from autism to ADHD to who knows what else. Look, I have a very, very simple metric when it comes to affirmative action for quote-unquote neurodiverse people or neuroinclusive people. Are you going to offer the same good or service that you would normally be able to offer if you were not, quote, neurodiverse or neuroinclusive? So if you are commercial airline pilots, just to take one example, because United Airlines has actually been in the news recently for their avowed commitment to making sure their pilots match the American population based on their racial, gender breakdown, all of this. By the way, you know, I mean, that should question United Airlines' safety. Are you going to sacrifice performance by doing this? So if you are a store and you have a customer service facing store clerk, or you have people helping you out in the aisles of the store, or let's say that you are a customer service representative over the phone, is the customer going to get the same experience? If the answer is yes, then I don't care. If the answer is no, then I care a lot. We as a country have just totally forsaken the idea of goodness, the idea of objective good, the idea of meritocracy. If meritocracy exists as anything more than a brain fart at this point that some of us still like to talk about, then I need to see some more welcome news for it, because we have totally forsaken objective good and meritocracy on the altar of the DEI regime. And the fact that we are going to suffer and get worse goods and worse services perhaps is not even a bug. It might actually genuinely be a feature to these misanthropes who are pushing these ridiculous policies. Google CEO calls AI tools woke response completely unacceptable. So you've probably seen by now just the outrageous stuff that has come out of Google's Gemini image creation program. This created quite an uproar. In fact, the uproar was so big in right of center circles that it forced Google to apologize and once again say that it was quote unquote completely unacceptable. Literally, if you put into the Gemini algorithm, "Hey Google, show me what a Nazi criminal or a Nazi Hitler functionary bureaucrat from the 1940s looked like," they would give you like an Asian woman. I mean, like, you can't make this up. It categorically refused. The Gemini program categorically refused to spit out a single image, at least that I saw, of a white person. Even if you literally said, "Hey, Google, show me a white person from 800 years ago," it wouldn't do it. And it's a direct reminder that he who controls the algorithms, in this case, he who controls the tools, he who controls the programs in general, ultimately controls how people think. Google should be very familiar with this, actually. In the 2016 presidential election, a PhD, a guy who ended up testifying in the U.S. Senate in 2017 or 2018, a guy by the name of Dr. Robert Epstein, he ended up testifying, and he was a Hillary Clinton voter, but he ended up testifying that Google single-handedly manipulated the 2016 election to the tune of 3 million votes approximately to Hillary Clinton, simply based on how they manipulated their search algorithms. In other words, what Google would do during the 2016 election cycle is on page one of their search results, they would put pro-Hillary, anti-Trump articles, and then they would bury the articles that would get you to the other conclusion. So Google is a company, it's an evil company first and foremost, but they are all too familiar with the idea that if you control the gateway to information, then you control how people think, how they perceive reality, and ultimately you really do control the world. It's harrowing stuff. I am frankly just utterly terrified of AI in general, trying to make my peace with it, frankly, because I fear that it is here to stay. But this situation right here with this Gemini ahistorical garbage really does shine a very bright light on some of the dangers and potential pitfalls. Mary Poppins gets a new age rating in Britain for racist language. So I'm sure you've seen the 1964 classic Mary Poppins. Well, apparently it includes two uses of the term Hottentots, which I literally had to, no pun intended, because of what we were just talking about, I had to Google that. I actually had no idea what that mean. Well, apparently it's a discriminatory term that entered our language initially in the late 17th century. It was a name applied by white Europeans to the Khoikhoi. I don't even know who the Khoikhoi are, to be honest with you, but allegedly in the year 2024 in the UK, this extraordinarily classic film, one of the most celebrated, most watched films of the entire 20th century, apparently they're condemning this so much that they actually have to change the age guidelines. So it no longer has what is in the UK the equivalent of a G rating, kind of what the Disney movies get in the theaters, basically meaning it is kid-friendly. And again, this is just total historical revisionist bullcrap. Back in 1964, when this film was made, do you think anyone cared whatsoever about a couple of uses of an obscure, abstruse term that 95%+ of the audience probably had no idea what these people were even talking about? No, obviously not. This entire notion of trying to revise history and retcon history to try to view it through a distinctly modern 21st century lens gets you into so many problems here. It's the exact same mentality as this that gets you to the mass condemnation of the American founders as a bunch of white male slaveholders. How can we possibly care what they have to say? It gets you to the ridiculous conclusion that Abraham Lincoln was a bad guy because he maybe said a bad thing here or there about black people. Absolutely insane. Judge people at their time based on the prevailing morals of the time. You know, I think back to the Bible and in what we Jews call this the second parsha, the second portion of the Torah in the annual cycle of reading the Torah, Parsha Noah, the story of Noah's Ark. What do we learn about Noah? We learn that he was a, quote, righteous man for his generation. Note that they don't say that he was a, quote, righteous man, period. They say he was a righteous man for his generation. It is that idea of generational, situational, for his time morality and ethics that we would do a really, really good job to try to recover that understanding today. I suspect if we did, you would not see idiocy like this involving Mary Poppins. Finally, an article from Katrina Gibson, quote, as a black woman and physician, it's time to end microaggressions in medicine. So Katrina Gibson says that, quote, verbally aggressive, intimidating, or angry, these are thinly veiled racist dog whistles aimed against black physicians like me. So let me understand this clearly. Just because you happen to be black and or you happen to be a woman, that does that mean that no one can accuse you, rightly perhaps, of being aggressive, intimidating, or angry? Well, what if you just are aggressive, intimidating, or angry? You know, when I saw Fani Willis on the witness stand down there in Fulton County, Georgia, during that first hearing earlier in February involving Nathan Wade and whether she should be disqualified because they were shacking up when she hired him. It's a whole mess. First of all, she sounded like an idiot. She literally didn't know what continent Belize was on. Belize is in Central America, if you haven't checked, Fani. But you know what she came across as? Very aggressive and angry. And I'm not going to stop saying that because she's a black woman. She was very aggressive and angry. That does not make me racist for properly viewing her conduct on the stand, first of all, as totally not what a district attorney, a public official, let alone one prosecuting a former president of the United States, clearly should not be acting like that. But objectively speaking, relative to the median American who might be a witness at that stand, she was aggressive and angry. So I am not going to censor myself, and you cannot censor yourself either. Do not live your life like that. It's a very, very bad way to live your life.
The Josh Hammer Show.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.